Greetings to all of you. I'm kind of a stranger in a strange land here because this is Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I'm from Maryland. So with respect to sports in this area, are we oriented more toward Philadelphia or Pittsburgh?
More between Philadelphia and Baltimore.
Philadelphia and Baltimore. Okay. All right. So I want to tell you a joke. I want to start by telling a joke. And this is contrary to most jokes that you've heard. I hope you don't get it, because I want to make a point with this joke. All right. So the joke is, what does Michael Jackson have in common with the Phillies? Well, the answer is, they both wear one glove for no apparent reason. Well, so, some of you got it, but now imagine somebody from, say, China, and you had told the person from China this joke. Well, he wouldn't know anything probably about baseball. He might not know anything about Michael Jackson. And if you said the Phillies, maybe he'd think you were talking about horses. Who knows? But a person from a different culture would be totally unable to grasp that joke. Now, when we start to read, because of the difference in culture and the lack of knowledge about local history and the name, you know, the name of the baseball team in Philadelphia, of course, is the Phillies. If I had said the Pirates, you know, if I used the Pirates in that joke, he might be wondering, well, why would a Pirate wear one glove? He wouldn't know that baseball players wear one glove, and for whatever reason, Michael Jackson wore one glove. He might not know all those things. So there's a lot that you need to know just to understand a simple joke like the one I just told. And when we go to read the Bible, we're reading about cultures that we're not familiar with, and perhaps history that we haven't learned had an impact on what was written. We're reading about people and institutions that we have limited knowledge about. And so what I wanted to do today is discuss some of the culture and the history and the institutions and the people that were the reason that some of the things that we read in the Bible came to be written there. And specifically, I'm talking about the Gospels today. So I want to give an introduction, just a background, some background information about the state of affairs in Judea and the areas around it at the time the Gospels were written, in the hope that it'll give us a better understanding of the Bible itself. So if the kids are watching, this is the Jordan River that Bonnie was talking about. It runs from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. And this is Galilee. This is where Jesus grew up. And the city that Mr. Stashek was discussing last week is up in this area someplace. And we see that this is Samaria. Samaria, you remember, used to be the capital of Israel, the northern 10 tribes. And this area down here is Judea. So all of these regions were kind of divided up among Herod and his sons. But I want to talk about a force that influenced a lot of culture in the area of the Middle East and the Far East at and before the time of Christ. And one of the main forces was a movement called Hellenism. Now, Hellas was the name of ancient Greece. That's way back in antiquity, perhaps before 500 BC. Hellas was the name of Greece. And Hellenism is the movement that impelled the ancient world to speak like Greeks and to live like Greeks and to adopt Greek culture and Greek philosophy. And it caused people to imitate the Greeks. And I want to read you an excerpt from a book entitled The New Testament Milieu. It says, the final phase of Hellenism, the first phase was marked by the rapid spread of Greek culture and civilization. Greek colonies were settled in the conquered territories. Cities with Greek names and Greek character were established. Greek soldiers, along with many Greek scholars and other citizens, such as merchants, also settled in those areas. And it was not long before gymnasiums, theaters, running tracks, museums, baths, etc. were constructed in the genuinely Greek style. Greek dress and Greek customs were adopted, particularly by the well-to-do. But this first phase actually affected only the highest strata of the population in the various places. The general populace was scarcely attracted by the Greek spirit. So some people adapted to Hellenism and some did not. In fact, in most countries, the process was met by opposition of one sort or another. The second phase, in reaction to the first, led people to a fresh appreciation of their own cultural assets. And sometimes, as in Palestine, under the Maccabees and in Egypt, there was open confrontation with the Hellenistic powers. We may describe the third phase as that of syncretism, which reached its zenith with the founding of the Roman Empire. So the syncretism is an amalgamation of the Greek culture and philosophy with the local indigenous culture and philosophy, and to make a combination of the two. So Greek culture and Greek philosophy, Greek civilization was spread around the world around 325 BC by Alexander the Great as he and his armies conquered the known world. Of course, their philosophy included the ideas of Plato and of Socrates. These men were proponents of the idea of the immortality of the soul. Socrates quite happily took poison, as he was commanded to do, because he thought that when his earthly body died, his eternal immortal spirit would be released from its prison. So he believed, as did Plato, in the immortality of the human soul. Alexander himself was a student of Aristotle. Aristotle is the man who created the idea of the geocentric universe. He taught that the earth was at the center of everything, and all the stars and the planets rotated around the earth, mounted on crystal spheres which could be seen through. And this terrible idea didn't die until the 17th century, when Galileo proved that that could not be possible. So modern Christianity is a syncretism. It's a joining together, an amalgamation, a melding of Greek and Roman and Jewish and Christian ideas. But Alexander wanted the empire to bear the lasting imprint of Greek culture. So he was successful in influencing the entire world with Greek culture. Greek became the universal language, as English is today. And in the time of the Greek rule over Judea, Greek culture was forcibly imposed on the Jewish people. So as a result, Hellenism left its mark on Jewish culture and Jewish religion. Now, one group of people that we encounter quite a bit in the Gospels is the Pharisees, and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the political and religious groups that had an influence on the lives of the people who lived in Judea and on Christ and on the apostles. So I want to talk about the Pharisees. The Pharisees were a society of priests and scribes. They were adherents to the oral law. They taught that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai the written law and also an oral law, which he did not write down, they claim. However, the Bible says that Moses wrote down everything that God said. But the Pharisees had this oral law as well as the scriptures. The oral law was the source of all those obnoxious rules that we've heard about, how to keep the Sabbath, the very strict regulations that they imposed on the people as doctrine. Christ said that you teach for doctrine the commandments of men. So they imposed their commandments, their own doctrine, their injunctions, to the same degree, and perhaps even to a greater degree, than the teaching of the law. The name Pharisee means separate, because they kept themselves separate from anything and anyone that was perceived as impure. Let's turn over to Luke, read about how this idea that they were supposed to be separate and pure, how this affected them, and how it contrasted with the attitude of Jesus Christ. Luke 7, verse 39 is the story where a Pharisee invites Jesus to dinner. And while they're eating at dinner, a woman comes in, and I forget which example this is. I think this is where she She washes his feet with her and dries them with her hair. And the Pharisees believed that you shouldn't come into contact, any kind of contact at all, especially physical contact, with sinners. And this is how the Pharisee assessed the situation. It says, when the Pharisee, which had bidden him, saw it, he spoke within himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman that this is that touches him, for she is a sinner. So the Pharisees would not have allowed himself to come into contact, especially physical contact, with a sinner, as he perceived this woman to be. He didn't perceive that he himself was also a sinner. The Pharisees despised the common people who didn't abide by all their laws and injunctions. They called them the people of the land. And this attitude toward people is evident also in Luke. Let's turn over to Luke 18. This is a well-known parable that Christ told about the two men who went up to the temple to pray. Luke 18, verse 11 says, the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, and he said, God, I thank you that I'm not as other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican, this tax collector. So the Pharisees despised others whom they perceived were not as righteous, not as pure, not as separate from sin as they were. The Pharisees' sphere of influence was not in the temple, as we might think. Their sphere of influence was the synagogue, the various synagogues in the city. And Jesus claims about his identity and his authority and his mission represented threats to their authority within the synagogue, threats to their status, and threats to their source of wealth and income and influence. Let's turn over to Matthew 23, see how Jesus viewed the Pharisees. Jesus branded the scribes and the Pharisees as grandstanders and hypocrites. Matthew 23, verse 13, Jesus says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, and for neither go you in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore, you shall receive the greater judgment. So, Christ had a very low opinion, obviously, of the Pharisees, in contrast to their very high opinion of themselves. But the traditions of the Pharisees survived the sack of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In fact, Everett Harrison, who wrote a book called Introduction to the New Testament, says that Pharisaic tradition is the source of modern rabbinic Judaism. So many of their teachings, many of their traditions survived the sack of Jerusalem, which is in contrast to the other prominent group of religious people at the time of Christ, the Sadducees. Remember we said the word Pharisee means separatist, the word Sadducee means purist. And they say that they were named for Zadok, who was the priest, the high priest in the time of Solomon. The Sadducees were aristocratic and wealthy priests, and they were in charge of the temple, whereas the Pharisees were in charge of the synagogue. The Sadducees were in charge of the temple, and they were the majority in the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin comes from a Greek word, synedron, which means council. So they were in charge of the Sanhedrin. Let me see if I have a slide to show you. Maybe we'll go back to that. Yeah, this is getting back to Hellenism. This is Athens at the time of Christ, and you have the Parthenon, and across the valley from it, this is Mars Hill, where Paul made a speech. So I wanted to show you this to give you some kind of an impression about Greek architecture and why the Greeks thought they had something of value that should be spread throughout the world. This is a picture of the Sanhedrin. The caption says, the Jewish high court consisted of 71 men. It was led by the high priest. We'll get into that a little bit later. So they were, the Sadducees were the majority in the Sanhedrin, and contrary to the belief of the Pharisees, the Sadducees did not support the oral law. They believed only in the authority of the Pentateuch. They did read the rest of the Bible with the exception of the book of Esther, which they gave no credence to, but they placed most of their emphasis on the Pentateuch. They did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. They did not believe in angels or spirits. The beliefs of the Sadducees made them more susceptible to Hellenization than the beliefs of the Pharisees. And a couple sources said that their morality was eclipsed by their desire for expediency. Now, both Annas and Caiaphas, remember that Caiaphas was the high priest who examined Christ when Christ was taken to trial in the Sanhedrin. Both Annas and Caiaphas were Sadducees, not Pharisees. Let's turn over to John. John 11. Remember, the Sadducees did whatever was politically expedient. If the ends justified the means, they were all for it. John 11, verse 47. This is while they're plotting the arrest and the false accusations and the murder of Jesus Christ. It says, 11:47, book of John, "Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council, a synhedron." This is the Sanhedrin. "And they said, 'What are we going to do? This man does many miracles. If we let him alone, all men will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place, our offices, and our nation.' And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said to them, 'You don't know anything at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation wouldn't perish.'" So expediency was the prime motivation of the Sadducees. And unlike the Pharisees, when the temple and all of Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD, their traditions and their teaching did not survive. So the Sanhedrin, which we were discussing a minute ago, met in this chamber, which is over here in this corner of the temple complex. This is the temple proper. This is where the Holy of Holies would be. And the chamber that you're looking at here would have been located in this little section here. It says the council could decide almost any fate except for the death penalty, which was decided by the Romans. That's why when Jesus was tried, he was brought before the Sanhedrin and tried on the charge of blasphemy. But when he was turned over to the Romans, because the Jews were not able to execute him, when he was turned over to the Romans, the charge got changed from blasphemy to sedition. So because the Sanhedrin was not allowed to execute capital punishment, they had to turn him over to the Romans to get that done. So when you read in the New Testament about the council, it's talking about the Sanhedrin. As in fact, the Greek word for council is synhedron. So it was a council of 70 priests, a judicial court that interpreted Jewish life, custom, and law. It was presided over by the high priest, and he would be here. Whoops, sorry. This would be the high priest. This is where the accused is. And there are 35 members on either side. The majority of them are Sadducees. I'm sorry, the majority of them are Sadducees. The majority of the council, the Sanhedrin, was Sadducees. So this is the council, and this is the chamber where Christ would have been tried before the Sanhedrin. Luke 22, verse 66. They were not allowed to convene at night. Sanhedrin could not meet at night. They couldn't. It was illegal to have a trial at night. It says, Luke 22, verse 66, "As soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him to their council, saying, 'Are you the Christ? Tell us.' And he said to them, 'If I tell you, you will not believe.'" So this This is the council and this is the chamber where Christ would have been tried before the Sanhedrin. And it's also the place where, in Acts 4, where Peter and John would have been brought to be tried, and later Stephen and Paul as well. So then we've got another group that really wasn't very influential, but we ought to talk about them, called the Essenes. This was a Jewish sect that originated in the 2nd century B.C. They were extremely conservative, extremely strict. They are associated with the Qumran community that preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I think I've got a slide to show you. This is a picture of the cliffs and the caves down in Qumran, down in the south near the Dead Sea where these people live. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in caves such as these, and they were scrolls written on parchment because of the extremely desiccated and very, very dry conditions down there in the Dead Sea area. These things were preserved for more than 2,000 years in clay pots. A shepherd boy apparently was throwing rocks and threw a rock into one of these caves, and he heard the crash of something that sounded like pottery. And when he went into the cave, he found many, many jars filled with ancient papyrus and what's the other one? Not vellum, but the word will come to me later when I'm on my way home. Okay, so these Essenes were, all property was held by the community. They were celibate. They did not marry. Sabbath observance was especially strict. They don't seem to have had any important influence on the gospel or the writers of the gospels. Some people have suggested that John the Baptist was of this sect, but most commentaries say there's really no good reason to believe that. There was also a group that originated around 6 AD called the Zealots. The Zealots were called the fourth philosophy among the Jews, I think by Josephus. They were founded in 6 AD by Judas the Galilean. They protested paying tribute to Rome, because it was an empire that worshipped idols, and I guess they were ultra-conservative in their religious viewpoint. But their revolt was crushed in 6 AD by the Romans. But the spirit of the zealot spirit remained alive for decades. I guess it's like the Confederacy. Still see Confederate flags and pickup trucks in the South. In fact, let's turn over to Luke. One of the disciples is described as a zealot. Luke 6 and verse 13, talking about the calling of the disciples. It says, when it was day, he called unto him his disciples, and of them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles. Simon, whom he also named Peter, Petros, it means a pebble, and Andrew, his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, called Zelotes. So the Bible tells us that Simon may have been of the party of zealots. The Harper's Bible Dictionary says, it would seem then that the epithet zealot used of Simon perhaps refers to the older sense of the word, namely a person who is devoted to the law, who is zealous for God. So we don't know whether Simon was actually of the party of zealots, which still had some adherents at that time, or whether they were just saying that Simon was zealous of God. And you've heard of Masada. That was the last zealot stronghold after the war that lasted from 66 AD to 73 AD, the war in which Jerusalem was sacked by Rome. Masada, way down in the south, huge bastion that was built by Herod the Great, finally fell to the Romans in 74 AD. Well, remember, we looked at the map. Let's go back to the map. And we talked about how Jesus grew up in Galilee here, and Judea is here. And you have to notice that the space in between is called Samaria. Now, a little ancient history. We had Solomon. Solomon's son Rehoboam increased the taxes on the Jewish people, on the kingdom of Israel. It was a united kingdom. At that time, say 900 to 950 B.C. This entire area was called Israel. It leaked over across the Jordan River as well. So all of that was Israel. It was all it was the United Kingdom under King David. David had a son named Solomon. Solomon raised taxes. After the death of Solomon, the people came to his son, Rehoboam, and said, "Your dad taxed us pretty heavily. Why don't you reduce the taxes? If you reduce the taxes, this people is going to love you forever, will be loyal to you forever." But Rehoboam didn't listen to his people or the counselors who told him to reduce taxes. He did the opposite. He raised taxes. There was a tax revolt, and the northern kingdom, the northern 10 tribes encompassing this area, rebelled. All right, so things went on like that for about 250, 300 years until the northern kingdom was sacked, was defeated in battle by the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, this was 723 B.C., so the Assyrians took all the indigenous people out of this area. Now remember, the Assyrians did not conquer Judah. You remember the story about Hezekiah, how Hezekiah received a letter from the general of the Assyrian army, and he spread it out in prayer before God, and he said, "These people have mocked you, God." And that night, 150,000 men died. It was hundreds of thousands because God saved Judah. Because Judah had been much more observant of God's laws and righteous than the northern tribes of Assyria. Remember, we had kings like Ahab and his wife Jezebel. These are the people that were driving the kind of behavior in the northern kingdom of Samaria. And God, in 723, the Assyrians came down and took the northern kingdom, took the northern 10 tribes, just took them out of the land, dispossessed them of the land, and exiled them far to the east and to the north. And yet, Judah, the kingdom of Judah, was not conquered at that time by Assyria, and Judah remained. But the northern 10 tribes, which had split off from Israel and became Samaria, they were taken away and lost. So the Assyrians exiled the indigenous population, and they brought in people from the other parts of their empire to inhabit the land. Let's go back to 2 Kings and read about what happened there. 2 Kings 17. Second Kings 17:24, it says, "The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cuthah and from Ava, from Hamath, from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the land, in the cities of Samaria, instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities of it. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling that they feared the Lord, not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, 'The nations which you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land.'" Now, people used to think that there were various gods in different parts of the earth, and that these gods had authority or hegemony over certain parts of the land. And they thought, well, in this land, Samaria, there's a God here we don't know, and we don't know how to appease this God. So then in verse 27, "The king of Samaria commanded, saying, 'Carry thither one of the priests whom you brought from thence, and let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land.'" They didn't realize that he was teaching them the manner of the God of the whole earth. They thought this was a local God. "And then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear God. However, every nation made gods of their own and put them in the thrones of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt." But this one priest was able to inculcate some kind of worship that was supposed to, it was an attempt to direct that worship toward the eternal, toward Yahweh, toward the God of Israel. And over time, they developed their own version of the Pentateuch, and they had some form of observance, and they considered themselves to be the children of Abraham. And because they did this, the Jews hated them and would have nothing to do with them. So Let's turn over to John chapter 4, because Jesus stopped at a well while he was in Samaria to talk to a woman of the land, and she was a bit surprised that he'd even take the time of day to stop and talk to her. So John 4, verse 9. She's shocked that a Jewish man is talking to her. She says, "Then said the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that you, being a Jew, ask drink of me, which are a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." The Jews would not even walk through Samaria if they had to go from one end of the land to the other. If you were in Jerusalem and you had to go to Galilee, you'd walk around Samaria. You wouldn't take the short route through it, you'd walk around it. They wouldn't even go through it. One of the worst epithets in the land of Judea in the time of Jesus was to be called a Samaritan. Let's turn over to John. Jesus is having one of his classic confrontations with the Pharisees. And it's interesting that Jesus labels them exactly what they are, and all they can do is call him names, which really have no foundation. John 8, verse 48, "Then answered the Jews and said to Jesus, Aren't we right when we say that you're a Samaritan and you have a devil?" So this was about the worst thing they could think of to say to Jesus. That's John 8, 48. They call him a Samaritan, and they compounded that. Let's look up at verse 41. Christ says to them, "You do the deeds of your father." That was the truth. Their father was the devil. He said, "You do the deeds of your father." And then they say to him, "We are not born of fornication. We have one God, our one Father, even God." So not only did they call him a Samaritan, they called him the illegitimate bastard son of a Samaritan. Just one rotten name, one rotten epithet, one rotten insult after another. But Jesus felt he had to go to Samaria and teach these people, perhaps because they were making some effort to worship the God of Israel, even if they didn't do it perfectly, even if they did it ignorantly. In John 4, verse 3, it says, "He, Jesus, left Samaria and departed again unto Galilee, and he must needs go through Samaria." So he felt that he had to go to Samaria. He had to go there and to teach these people. And truly, Christ received more respect and he did more teaching in Samaria than he was able to do in his own land. As he said, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. Well, obviously Judah was an occupied state at the time Jesus was there. There were always at least four legions of Roman soldiers. A legion consisting of 3,000 to 6,000 men. So there could have been as many as 24,000 Roman soldiers stationed in Judea when Pontius Pilate was the governor. And during feast times, when there was increased chance of some kind of uproar or problem, the number of troops would be increased. There were three or four main functions of Roman soldiers in the provinces that Rome occupied. First of all, they were there to preserve order. Let's go to Acts 19. This is one of the cases where Paul has caused an uproar by his teaching. And the local administrators are concerned that the Romans find out there's been a near riot in the city. So one of the main jobs of the Roman soldier was to preserve order. In Acts 19:39, he says, "If you inquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in a lawful assembly. For we are in danger to be called into question for the day's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse." So the Romans were very, very concerned about maintaining order in a city. Kind of reminds me of Mayor Richard Daley, during the 1968 police riots. Remember, anyone remember that in Chicago? when he gave the famous quote, "The police are not here to create disorder. The police are here to preserve disorder." That's not exactly what he meant. Well, the second function of the Roman soldiers was to guard prisoners. Acts 12:3, "And because he, Herod, saw it pleased the Jews, he further proceeded to take Peter also." So he took James and killed him, and then he took Peter also. These were the days of unleavened bread. "And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people." So one of the functions of Roman soldiers was to guard prisoners, and they guarded Peter until an angel let him out of prison. Of course, turn over to John 19. One of their duties was to execute criminals. That's another duty of the Roman soldier, execute criminals. John 19, verse 23, "Then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments and made four parts, to every soldier a part, and also his coat. Now the coat was without seam, woven from the top throughout." So these Roman soldiers, they were the ones who had to execute capital punishment on Jesus. And soldiers, let's turn over now to Matthew 5. Soldiers had the right in a province where they were stationed to press civilians into service. Jesus says in Matthew 5:41, "If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Give those to ask, and don't turn away from those who want to borrow." So the Roman soldiers played a big part in the gospel. Of course, we're talking about an occupied country, Judea. Okay. Another group of people who figure prominently in the Gospels are tax collectors. Tax collectors were despised and hated back in those days even more than they are today. Even more than we the animosity that we feel sometimes toward the Internal Revenue Service, it was 100 times greater in the day of Jesus toward tax collectors, because they collected taxes for Rome. They were hated by the Jews. They were seen as collaborators with the occupation army. They were known to extort, to swindle, and to blackmail. If you were trying to bring in some kind of contraband without paying taxes on it, the taxpayers found out, if it was more lucrative for the taxpayer to blackmail you, he would do that rather than collect the taxes. I guess in modern parlance, used car salesman doesn't even come close to the bad reputation that taxpayers had, or tax collectors had, in those days. Let's turn over to Luke 19, verse 7. Jesus has an encounter with a taxpayer. Tax collectors were all presumed to be guilty sinners and criminals. Luke 19, verse 7. Let's go to verse 8. "Zacchaeus, who is a taxpayer, stood and said to the Lord, 'Behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold.'" So I don't know if this guy Zacchaeus was a righteous individual all along, or if he had repented on this spot and decided to restore what he had taken fourfold. But Christ said to him, "This day salvation has come to this house, for as much as he is also a son of Abraham." It's hard to tell whether Zacchaeus was a righteous taxpayer or just a taxpayer or tax collector who repented. But the tax collectors collected taxes on everything. They were very creative in the taxes that they could make up. Even Matthew, one of the gospel writers, was a tax collector before his calling to discipleship. Well, now let's talk a little bit about the nation of Judah. You remember that we talked about how Israel was one kingdom, but after the reign of Solomon, it split into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of 10 tribes and the lower kingdom, the southern kingdom, Judah. The northern kingdom was defeated by the Assyrian army in 721 BC. And Judah didn't repent of its sins either, so God sent the Babylonians And they were defeated Judah in the period of 603 to 597 BC. So Babylon exiled many of the people of Judah as well, as the Assyrians had done 120 years earlier to Israel. And Babylon ruled over Judah for 70 years. But after 70 years, the Persians defeated Babylon. So let's kind of look at some of the kingdoms that raged back and forth over the Holy Land. This is, of course, a wider picture than we were looking at before. Here's Jerusalem. Here's Samaria up here. Judah was conquered by Babylon in 603 to 597. So this is the Babylonian Empire. And after 70 years after Babylon became a great nation, it was overthrown by the Persians. Oh, this is a picture of Babylon. Babylon was a great city. And it said of the wall around Babylon that four chariots could drive around this wall abreast. That's how large the wall was. And the Euphrates River flowed right through the middle of Babylon, right under the gate. And the Persians defeated the Babylonians. They got entrance to the city by diverting the river, and then they came in through the dry riverbed. But Babylon was a magnificent city, apparently. There's not much left of it today. So this is the Persian Empire, and all these empires, as you can see, incorporate about the same territory, the same area. The Persians were defeated by the Greeks, say 325, 350 BC. So this is the Greek Empire. And then finally, the Greeks were defeated by the Romans. And if you look at all the maps, you can see it's about the same territory, the same area, just different names on the map. So in accordance with Daniel's vision, the statue that had the head of gold, the chest of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, and the legs and feet of iron mixed with clay, that was a prophecy of these four world ruling empires that would roll through this area and take command of everything and own everything. And the states that they conquered would have to pay tribute to them, and there would be no home rule. They would be under the government, under the rule of these foreign states. And it was Babylon, and then Persia, and then Greece, and then Rome. So at the time of Christ, Jerusalem and Judea, they're under the rule of the Romans. But just before that, they had been under the rule of the Greeks. And that began, as I said, with Alexander the Great in about, 325 BC. And after his death, that kingdom was split up between his four generals. And around that time, 167 BC, one Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, was the ruler over Judea. And Antiochus attempted to eradicate Jewish culture and religion and replace it with Greek. In the time of Antiochus, the early 160s BC, a Greek-style gymnasium was built near the temple. Young men routinely exercised in the Greek fashion, that is to say, naked, near the temple. There were a lot of people who were proponents of the Hellenistic way of life, and also many who opposed it. There were two factions in Judah, and the struggle led to open revolt. Now, Antiochus was in Egypt when violence broke out over the office of the high priest and how that was being administered. And it was between the pro and the anti-Hellenistic factions. And Antiochus perceived that this affair was resistance to his rule and a revolt against him. So he launched an attack against Jerusalem, resulting in great loss of life. And then he resolved to prohibit completely the observance of Jewish religion and Jewish culture. He prohibited Sabbath observance. He prohibited the sacrifices. He prohibited circumcision. All these things were banned. We're all familiar with the occasion in 168. He defiled the temple by erecting an altar of Jupiter Olympus. And he also offered swine's flesh on the altar. Now there was a priest named Mattathias. And in 167, Mattathias was going to be compelled, forced, to make a sacrifice to an idol, to a Greek idol. And he refused to do it. But as I said, there were anti and also pro-Hellenistic forces and factions within Judea. And another priest came forward and agreed to make this sacrifice. Mattathias killed him, and he and his sons had to flee into the mountains. And he began a guerrilla warfare that lasted 2 years. Now, during this guerrilla warfare, he had some unique tactics for recruiting people to his side. For a long time, it had been forbidden to circumcise. So Mattathias and his sons and their allies, they would kidnap men and circumcise them if they hadn't been circumcised, so that they really kind of were forced to join him. So they conducted a guerrilla warfare for about 2 years, and in 165, Mattathias and the Maccabees, this was called the Maccabean Rebellion, they were successful and they overthrew, to one extent, Greek rule. And in 165, the temple was rededicated and purified. We have today the Jewish Festival of Lights called Hanukkah, which is an outgrowth from the purification of the temple in late December of 165 B.C. Because one of the ancestors of Mattathias was called Hasmon, this is known as the Hasmonean dynasty. So the Hasmonean dynasty ruled over Judah with varying degrees of independence for about 100 years until in 63 B.C. when Rome was beginning to replace Greece as the power in the Middle East. Rome conquered Judea in 63 B.C. under the Roman general Pompey, and they overthrew the Hasmonean dynasty. So think about this. Go back from the time of Christ, which is about Christ was born in 4 or 5 B.C. And at that time, Judah had been a tributary, a vassal state for 600 years. Imagine that. They had been under foreign rule. They had paid taxes to a foreign power for 600 years. And the Jews were looking for, hoping for, expecting a deliverer who would restore home rule. That was the state of mind of the Jews at the time of Christ. And all the apostles thought that that was Jesus' responsibility and his job. Let's turn over to Luke 24. Because after the crucifixion, their bubble had been burst. They were disillusioned, disappointed, grief-stricken, because they misunderstood the mission for which Jesus came. Luke 24, verse 21, the apostles are saying that we trusted that it had been He which should have redeemed Israel, and besides to this day, this is the third day since all those things were done. So the apostles thought that Jesus was the deliverer who at that time was going to restore home rule in the Holy Land. Well, another thing that we have to consider is the faction called the Herodians. And of course, the chief of these is Herod the Great, who lived from 74 to 4 B.C. He was the client king of Judea. It was Herod the Great who rebuilt the second temple in Jerusalem. Herod was half Jew, half Edomite, and he was a skillful politician, and he bribed and manipulated and murdered and married his way to the top. He was a very skillful politician. He was allied to both Mark Antony and Octavian. These two are in opposition. Mark Antony and Cleopatra were going to amalgamate the kingdoms of Rome and Egypt. And they were defeated at the Battle of Actium by Octavian. I forget if he's the son or the grandson of Julius Caesar. But Herod the Great very skillfully switched his alliances whenever it was politically convenient. He was allied with Antony and Cleopatra until Octavian defeated him at the Battle of Actium, and then he skillfully switched allegiances and he convinced Octavian that he, Herod, was the friend of Octavian, even though he had supported Antony and Cleopatra in the battle with men and materiel. Herod was a madman who murdered many members of his own family and a great many others. He murdered two of his sons, whom he suspected of sedition, Aristobulus and Alexander. He had them strangled. He both loved and feared his wife, Mariamne. He married Mariamne because she was a descendant of the Hasmonean dynasty, and he thought it would be politically expedient for him to marry her, but he also loved her. But he gave an order that on a trip, he was going to go on a trip to Rome, and he commanded that if he didn't come back from that trip to Rome, if he was killed or assassinated while he was on that trip, that Mariamne should be killed, because if he couldn't have her, he didn't want anyone else to have her. Unfortunately, Mariamne found out about it, and Herod knew that she had found out, and after that, after he knew that she knew, he didn't trust her anymore, so he had Mariamne killed as well. He was a paranoid nut who murdered anyone who threatened to surpass him in terms of popularity. Now, the high priesthood was supposed to be hereditary. It was supposed to pass down from father to son, and the office was supposed to last until the death of the high priest, and then the new high priest would take over. But either the Greeks or the Romans, somewhere in there, the high priesthood had become an appointment. So Herod appointed a man named Ananelius to be the high priest. And I guess when he tired of the role, he transferred the title of high priest to his son, Aristobulus. Well, Aristobulus apparently was a tall, good-looking kid, and he was about 18 years old when he was made the high priest. And he was very popular with the people. Now, being very popular with the common folk in the kingdom of Herod is a dangerous position. Herod would immediately become paranoid and distrust anyone who surpassed him in popularity. So he threw a party for Aristobulus. And at the party, Herod suggested to Aristobulus that it was a hot day and maybe he'd like a swim. So Aristobulus took a swim in the pool, and what he didn't know was that Herod had two men lurking in the pool who drowned him. So Herod was not a nice guy. Yet he was responsible for colossal building projects. So let's just take a look at a little bit of Herod's family. This is a family tree, but it's kind of more like a honeysuckle vine than a family tree. I had to look at this for a while to understand it. This is Herod the Great. Is that not focused, or are my eyes worse than I thought they were? I guess it's okay. That's Herod the Great, and I couldn't figure this out. Here's one of his sons, also named Aristobulus. And here's Herodias. I couldn't figure this out for the longest time. Herodias is obviously Herod's granddaughter. But Herodias married Philip, Herod's son. So she married her uncle. All right, everybody with me on that? Well, after a while, for whatever reason, we know that, you remember Herod who imprisoned John the Baptist and had his wife had wanted his head cut off. Well, this is the woman who made that request. After a while, Herodias left Philip and she married the other uncle, Antipas. It's kind of twisted, isn't it? So, this is Herod Antipas, who was married to Herodias when she asked him to execute John the Baptist. Remember, this is the Herod that had John the Baptist in prison. So this is Herod Agrippa the First. This is Agrippa the Second and Felix. These are the two Herods who both had interviews with Paul late in the book of Acts. So that's a little bit about the twisted family tree of Herod the Great and his sons. Philip, who wasn't apparently a very bad guy, and Antipas, and Agrippa, and Felix, these people all figure prominently in the Gospels and in Acts. Okay. So So Herod was responsible, although he was a monster, he was responsible for some good things, some building projects. He fortified Jerusalem. You can see his fortress here. He was responsible for rebuilding the temple, which took many decades. The period of about 20 to 30 BC, there was a famine in the land. And during that famine, he imported grain and he reduced taxes, so he gave the people a little bit of relief. Let's turn over to Matthew, because what we've learned about Herod, how he murdered his wife, he murdered two of his sons. As a matter of fact, he wanted to murder Antipas, this guy here, and he gave the order to have him murdered. Unfortunately, he died 4 days before the execution was to be carried out, and it never was carried out. And Antipas is the... Then there's Archelaus. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago. Archelaus is the guy who Christ used in one of the parables. He's the king that went on a great journey to go away and get for himself a kingdom and to return. So Christ was using the example of Archelaus when he gave that parable. And remember that the people said, "We won't have this man to reign over us," while he was going to Rome to secure his portion of the kingdom. The citizens wrote a letter to the emperor and said, "We don't want this man to be our king. He's not fit." So Christ was using that example of this man in one of his parables. So Herod was responsible for building a lot of building projects in the land. He wanted to achieve immortality through those wonderful buildings. But he was a madman. Let's turn over to Matthew 2. Because what we've learned about Herod, how he murdered his wife and two of his sons, he murdered the high priest, he murdered a lot of other people. He was actually married. He had a total of 10 wives. What we learn about Herod's character makes this account believable. Matthew 2, verse 16. Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceedingly wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. So the barbarity of Herod and his paranoia and his desire to kill anyone who could become a threat to his kingship is given credence. It gives credence to this account in Matthew 2. Herod died in 4 BC. And we know that he was still alive when Christ was born. So this we can deduce from this that Christ could be born no later than 4 BC. 4 BC is the last day, the last year that Christ could have been born. Okay, let's go back again and look at the family tree. Let's turn over to Matthew 2, verse 9. Because Herod dies while Joseph and Christ and Mary are in Egypt. Matthew 2:19, when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother and go into the land of Egypt, for they are dead which sought the young child's life." And he arose and he took the young child and his mother and he came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus, this guy, when he heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go thither. Notwithstanding being warned of God in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee. So he went up north so he could get out of away from the influence of Archelaus. Herod Antipas, the tetrarch of Galilee, this is the guy Antipas who murdered John the Baptist, and he's also the Herod to whom Pilate sent Jesus. Remember, Pilate's trying to find somebody else to make this decision. So Pilate sent Jesus to Herod to have him interrogated by Herod, but Herod sent him back, and it was this Herod, Antipas, the same guy who had executed Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist. All right, so I'll skip the rest of the Herods. Of course, we have Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was the procurator of Judah from AD 26 to 36. Pilate was, you read the accounts of him and you get the idea that he was a bit of a loser. He was insensitive to the scruples and the religion of the Jews, and when he brought his legions into Jerusalem, he knew that the Judeans would object to the standards, which had the Roman flags and at the top of them a bust of the emperor, whom they worshipped as a god. And he knew that they would object to this, so he had it done at night. And of course, there was an uproar about that, and he finally had to remove them. He wanted to appropriate the temple funds, the temple treasury, to build an aqueduct. That caused problems. He heard that there was going to be a gathering of Jews at Mount Gerizim, where there were supposed to be relics of Moses. And so he sent armed soldiers dressed as civilians with swords and clubs under their clothing to make sure that there wasn't going to be an uprising or a riot. For whatever reason, violence broke out. There was great loss of life. So after that incident, Pilate was recalled to Rome. Well, the temple, of course, plays very prominently in the accounts of the Gospels. We can see the temple here on the east side of Jerusalem. Over across this valley is the Mount of Olives, where Jesus liked to go. And you can see the environs of Jerusalem. It appears to be not what we would call a city today. Maybe it was as big as Enola. It was just really a small town. And this is the temple itself. It was apparently an amazing and a very stunning complex built out of native marble. The stones were cut over on the west side, uphill from where the temple is. And there were massive, massive stones. The blocks that built the Great Pyramid are supposed to be about 40 tons, but the stones in the temple were about 200 tons. And they were chiseled out of this marble by chiseling rectangular channels along the length of the blocks, and then dry timbers would be forced into the spaces between the blocks, and then they'd be soaked with water. And as the timbers expanded, that would crack the stone at the base. So that's how these stones were cut. These massive stones, and they were all dressed and cut to size off-site, and then they were transported to the Temple Mount. So the precision of their carving is one of the wonders. The stones were much more massive than the stones even of the Great Pyramid. They were blindingly white. It was apparently difficult to look at the temple in daylight because the stones were so white and they reflected the light so much. And of course, parts of the temple were adorned with gold. Let's turn over to Matthew 24 because Christ brought the disciples down to Jerusalem or up to Jerusalem. Just before his last Passover. And the disciples were dazzled. These are country boys. These are fishermen from the northern parts of the country. They hadn't been to the big city before. It says in Matthew 24, verse 1, Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. They were just dazzled, and they had never seen anything like this. And it is an impressive and a very striking complex. Jesus burst their bubble. He said to them, "You see all these things?" He said, "Truly I say to you, there shall not be left one stone here upon another that shall not be thrown down." So I'm sure he really burst their bubble. They must have been dismayed to hear that. I want to call your attention to this feature around the outside of the temple. Anybody have an idea what that is?
I know what it is. Good.
This is the court of the Gentiles here. And this was a shoulder height wall beyond which the Gentiles could not pass except on the penalty of death. So this wall was built to keep the Gentiles out of the temple area. Paul nearly caused a riot when it was believed. Let's turn over to Acts 21. It was believed that Paul had brought a Gentile into the temple because somebody had seen this Gentile, Trophimus, who was an Ephesian. And since he had been seen around Jerusalem with Paul, it was assumed that Paul had brought him past this wall and into the temple. And Paul's being accused in Acts 21, verse 28, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teaches all men everywhere against the people and against the law and against this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple and has polluted this holy place. For they before had seen him in the city with Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." Well, this feature of the temple, you can search the Bible, you won't find anywhere that there's supposed to be a court of the Gentiles or a wall. Now let's turn over to Ephesians 2:11, a wall to keep the Gentiles away. Let's turn over to Ephesians 2:11 because that wall has spiritual significance for the church. Paul says in Ephesians 2:11, "Wherefore remember that you being in times past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called the uncircumcision, by that which is called the circumcision in the flesh made by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and stranger from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now Christ Jesus, whom you sometimes who you sometimes were far off, are made near by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of partition between us." So this wall, which was the partition between the Gentiles and the Jews, was broken down by Jesus Christ. Now the temple was maintained and administered by the Sadducees, and not only was it a place of worship, it should only have been a place of worship, but it was a huge commercial establishment. There was a concession operated in the temple by the Sadducees. They sold sacrificial animals and they exchanged money. And it was all a big scam because you couldn't buy the animals or pay temple tax with Roman currency because it had a figure of the emperor on it. That was an idol. So you had to exchange your money for temple money. And the exchange rate highly favored the bank. And the animals that you bought were highly overpriced. Now you think, well, I could bring my own animal. I've got a farm out there in the hills near Jerusalem, and I could bring my own lamb or my own cow and sacrifice it. But the priest would have to examine your animal, and according to the law, it had to be without blemish, right? Well, they'd find a blemish. If you brought your own animal to Jerusalem to sacrifice, they'd find a blemish on it. So you had, if you wanted to do a sacrifice, you'd have to buy their animals. So it was a scam. The Sadducees had a pretty neat scam running. Jesus cleaned this concession out of the temple just before his crucifixion. And he, at least for a time, he put a dent in the income of the Sadducees. Another reason for the Sadducees to want him dead. For the Jews, the temple symbolized God in their midst. But they should have looked at the veil, because the veil symbolized separation between all men and God. So since the temple's destruction in 70 AD by Titus, the sacrificial system is in abeyance. And it's interesting and a little bit disconcerting that the plunder of the temple and the treasures of the temple, it was that plunder, it was the artifacts and the goods taken out of the temple that financed the building of the Colosseum in Rome. Isn't that kind of a shame? Well, though the temple was the domain of the Sadducees, the synagogue, the center of Hebrew life, culture, and social world, was the synagogue was under the jurisdiction of the Pharisees. Generally, everybody was a member of the synagogue, and to be cast out of the synagogue was to become a social leper. According to the Talmud, from the New Manners and Customs of the Bible, it says, according to the Talmud, there were three different degrees of excommunication among the Jews. The first was called Nadin, and those on whom it was pronounced were not permitted for 30 days to have any communication with any person at a distance over 4 cubits or 6 feet. So you weren't allowed to come closer than 6 feet to your friends and relatives. They were not prohibited from attending public worship, though they could not during the 30 days enter the temple by the ordinary gate. They were not allowed to shave during that time, and they were required to wear garments of mourning. The second degree was called kerem, and was pronounced on those who remained openly disobedient under the first. It was the greater severity, and then there was a third, shamatha, which was inflicted on those who persisted in their stubborn resistance to authority, and by this they were cut off from all connection with Jewish people and were consigned to utter perdition. The Talmud assigns as the two general causes for excommunication money and Epicureanism. That's, I guess, a form of Hellenism. The first refers to those who refer to pay the monies that the court directed them to pay, and the second refers to those who despise the word of God or the scribes. Both of those things, the word of God and the scribes, being put on an equal basis, it says here. So let's look at an example of somebody who's thrown out of the synagogue. Let's turn over to John 9. John 9. The last thing you'd want would be to be put out of the synagogue. That was like being a leper. John 9. This is after Christ has healed a man who's been blind from birth. John 9, verse 13. They brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind. And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then again the Pharisees asked him how he had received his sight. And he said unto them, he put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and do see. Therefore said some of the Pharisees, this man is not of God, because he keeps not the Sabbath day. But others said, how can a man that's a sinner do such miracles? And there was a division among them. And then they said to the blind man again, what do you say of him that opened your eyes? He said, he's a prophet. But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him that had received his sight, and they asked them, saying, is this your son whom you say was born blind? It's as if this whole thing is some elaborate scam that the parents and the son have created. And they said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we don't know. Or who has opened his eyes, we don't know. He is of age, ask him, and he shall speak for himself. These words spoke his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. And we just read what that would mean. Therefore, his parents said, he's of age, ask him. This man's parents did not want to be thrown out of the synagogue, and they were willing to throw their own son under the bus to avoid the stigma. They would lose their social contacts, their business contacts, their entire circle of acquaintances. Well, the synagogue service, let's look at a picture of a typical synagogue. This is actually a recreation. Oh, there's another picture of the temple. Let me stop and talk about the temple a little more. This is Solomon's temple here. That's Solomon's temple. This is a football field. We're familiar with this. This would be 110 yards this way and 50 yards this way. So Solomon's temple was, say, 60% of the size of a modern football field. Of course, that temple was destroyed and rebuilt. Then there was the second temple after the Persians allowed the Jews to come back in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and repair the temple. So you can see how when Herod built his temple, that he greatly expanded. He built a much bigger foundation. He greatly expanded the size of the temple complex. I just thought that was interesting to see the size of those three temples. And if the people who made this chart are correct, this is the very grand temple that will be extant in the kingdom of God, because this is Ezekiel's temple that's talked about in the latter chapters of the book of Ezekiel. So I thought that was an interesting slide to give us a perspective of the relative sizes of the three temples. This is a reconstruction of a 4th century synagogue that's been unearthed in Capernaum. Capernaum, of course, is the town where Jesus first preached in Luke 4. I don't think that this is the synagogue that Christ preached in, but it appears to have been built on the ruins of an earlier synagogue. So perhaps the synagogue that Christ preached in Luke 4 is someplace under the foundation of this synagogue, which is in itself now in ruins. The men would sit in here in this area. The people who were reading and preaching scriptures, of course, would be up here. And the women, it says, inhabited the loft up around the top. So I just thought that was interesting to give you a little perspective about what a first to a fourth century synagogue might look like. So the synagogue service was pretty much like our service here. They'd have an opening prayer. They'd have something that was called the Confession of Faith, which was some scriptures from Deuteronomy that would be read. There would be the singing of songs, the psalms. It was kind of responsive. The priest would sing, and then the congregation would sing back to him what he had just sung. There was prayer. There was reading from the law. And one would stand up to read from the Torah. And you remember it said that Christ read in Luke 4, it says Christ read from Isaiah 61. It was handed to him the scroll of Isaiah the prophet, and he read portions of Isaiah 61. And then it said when he had finished reading, he sat down. Well, the tradition was you would stand up to read the law and you would sit down to teach. So Christ was giving the sermon that day. And that's when he said, this day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears, which made everybody terribly unhappy with him. After the sermon, which was given by the local priest or sometimes a guest speaker, there would be a closing prayer. That was the temple service in those times. Apparently, either by coincidence or by providential planning, Christ was asked to speak on that day, and he was given Isaiah to read, and he read Isaiah, and he read Isaiah 61, the part of the mission that he had at that time. So I think that I'm going to give another sermon next month about the nature of the four Gospels themselves, but I've just wanted to give you a little taste of the life and the times of the people and the cultural influences, the political influences that existed at the time of Christ. And I hope that this has been helpful to you, to give you a little bit of a better understanding of Jesus and his life and the gospel writers.